Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers produce over 600 varieties, types, and styles of cheese. That's twice as much as any other state. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, today is September 17th, Tuesday, 2019. We've got a special show today. Homebrewers have been an important part of the New York City scene since homebrewing started and the craft beer scene started over 20 years ago. Just back in the spring, our favorite beer writer, Jeff Allworth, in Burvana Blog wrote about how homebrewers built New York. And that's when we had Brett Taylor and Jeff Lyons with us, who had started out as award-winning homebrewers. And, you know, now they're both professional brewers. And we've also had a lot of other homebrewing news lately. Our good buddy, John LaPolia. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey there, Jimmy. How you doing, man?
Bitter and Esters won what award?
We won a Homebrew Shop of the Year from the American Homebrewers Association.
Yeah, so, you know, the thing about homebrewing in New York, it's like everywhere you turn, there's homebrewers who are now working in breweries, opening breweries. But then there's also, you know, this little homebrew shop, Bitter and Esters, that is a resource for so many brewers. So, Brett, say hello.
Hello.
Brett Taylor from?
Wild East Brewing Company.
Wild East Brewing. And today's a special day. I'm covering because we're waiting for Jeff Lyons from Keg and Lenten. But it's a special day because Josh Bernstein, who many of you know as a New York Times and, you know, author and prolific book author. Thanks, Matt. He's got a new book coming out. What's the name of the book, Brett?
Drink Better Beer.
Drink Better Beer, and he's going to be doing a launch party at
our construction site. There's going to be a brewery one of these days called Wild.
So there's a lot of things that it's the time with homebrew. Josh was one of the guys that recognized from an early stage how important the homebrew scene was. He hosted tours. His last book was called Homebrew World, where he took his like exploration of homebrewers to other countries and everything. So, but let's just start talking. So, John, congratulations! You won Homebrew Shop of the Year.
And what we actually won was the American Homebrewers Association asked the homebrew shops to have their clients, their customers, to nominate them for this award. And so it was not so much like you're the best homebrew shop, but it was more here is what your customers think of you. And we got a lot of customers who said, yeah, no, these guys should win this. And what I really liked about it, I mean, obviously it was nice to validate the work we've done for the past 8 years, but what I really liked was also that it was showing New York City in a different light. Because there's tons of homebrew shops. There's over 130 homebrew shops that were nominated for this award. And the West Coast is covered with them, right? So you would think someone in the West Coast would win or someone in the Midwest would win. But they picked out the only homebrew shop in New York City. And it was because of how strong this scene is here. And it made us feel good that there was like another light shine on here. The craft brew and the homebrew scene in New York City is just unbelievable right now.
Brett?
Bitter and Esters is the heart of it. You know, I we were talking before we came on that, you know, John said, I didn't teach Brett how to brew, but at the same time, I frequently can have questions for John. Yesterday, I was literally in the shop yesterday, and Jack helped me. He's one of the employees there. He helped me pick out some draft equipment that I needed for this event that we're doing tonight. And I don't make put together draft systems on the regular, especially homebrew ones. Now that I work in beer, and it was really great to have somebody sort of just tell me what I needed. There's no shame as a pro brewer and having your local homebrew shop tell you this is what you need to do this and this and this, because I deal with what interests me in beer and they deal with like every aspect of beer. So
we try to, yeah. And Jack has such a nice English accent, though, too. It's
very pleasant.
It is very pleasant. He's got a very pleasant accent.
Well, good. And, Jeff Lyons is coming in. So, Brett, you know, the article in Jeff Alworth's blog, you talked about a lot of things about homebrewers who are now brewing. Tell us about Jeff Lyons as he's walking in.
I mean,
how you guys work together, some of the homebrew clubs you guys are on.
Well, so I know Jeff because once upon a time in New York City, there were two homebrew shops. And I met Jeff at the one that was actually closer to me.
Because he was working there?
Because he was working there.
Do you know we hired him first and they took him?
I did not know that.
That's the truth.
Wow, the truth about Jeff Lyons is coming out.
New York City homebrew to pro legend.
Hey, Jeff.
Jeff Lyons. How are you, Jeff?
Hey, guys.
Thanks for coming over.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We were chatting about Bitter and Esther's winning the homebrew shop of the year.
Yay.
Yeah. Yes. Now, Brett, keep going. He's introducing you.
Yeah. That's right. I'm supposed to introduce Jeff. Jeff worked at Brooklyn Homebrew, the other homebrew shop. And I think they might have predated you.
Yeah, about 2 years.
Oh, okay. Wow. So yeah, by a bit. So, I used to go to the shop. It was close to my apartment and then it moved even closer to my apartment. And Jeff was the guy when I would go in there, I couldn't get out of there because we would always talk about mixed fermentation beers, which is what our true loves.
Great. So let's jump. So now let's talk about some of the homebrew legends or people that were winning prizes in your different homebrew competitions, you know, and who are now at brewing at breweries. Let's start talking about some people.
Chris Kuzmi would be
that's,
one.
That's a good one.
That's the number one.
So tell me about Chris and where he's working now.
He owns Fifth Hammer Brewing with his wife, Mary Izette.
And the great Dave Sharfstein.
And Dave
Sharfstein, yeah, but he's not a brewer.
He's not a brewer.
No, but Chris definitely was, you know, home brewer all the way. I'm in a band with him called the Home Brewsicians, which we kind of have to change the name to the Pro Brewsicians, I think, because...
you're losing them all.
Everyone's going pro in the band, pretty much. another one I think of is someone who's... working with Chris right now is Oscar Stern. You guys know Oscar?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was definitely homebrew, and he's gone, he's trying his best to go pro. He's climbing that ladder, right?
Oscar's working with us.
Oh!
At Keg and Lantern.
I lied. He
started with us, yeah.
He started with you, yeah. And then he went to Fifth Hammer?
Yeah.
Is he at both?
Both.
You know, that's this town,
we're,
man.
We're sharing the love.
The number that's of people who start at Fifth Hammer... I mean, I'm sorry, at Keg and Lantern, it's...
Right, you guys are the springboard.
Yeah. You guys are starting everywhere. I mean, I think you said and Garrett Oliver said that it's kind of the farm... There's different breweries that are like the farm team for the pros.
Yeah. We're like the double A. People work at my store, and then they go to another brewery and then another brewery. The head brewer at Six Point used to work for me. One of the owners of KCBC used to work at my store. Yeah, we're definitely.
Let's talk about your store because it was a number of years ago. I was working closely with Chris Kuzme, and he'd worked at 508 Gastrobrewery, and for a brief moment at my Jimmy's number 43, I was talking to him, and I even talked to Jason Saylor about there was a back prep room that was tiled with plumbing and electric that could have been a little small restaurant brewery license. And Chris Kuzme said to me, "What did he say?"
So take a class at Bitter and Esther's, learn how to brew, Jimmy.
So it was like, what was it, Brewery 101?
Yeah, yeah, the very basics, yeah.
So I've been a chef and a cook and all that, but I've got my limitations, and it was 2-hour class. Everything, John just kept spraying sanitizer on everything. What's the sanitizer you recommend, John?
Star Sand is the sanitizer that I sprayed on you, Jimmy.
It was everything he sprayed on.
My tombstone's going to say John LaPola, the guy who talked Jimmy Carbone out of brewing beer. That's what I was going to say. It's my epitaph.
I'm a skillet cooker. Let Cruze all the way.
Yeah.
And then Jeff, you guys, Keg and Larin, you've also been like this little farm team. I mean, for me, it was like you're at Greenpoint before, but Keg and Larin, Patrick worked there. Now he's at Westkill Brewing. Tell us about some of the people that have been gone through where you've worked.
Absolutely. But even to wind it back a gear or two, when Kuzme was at 508, that was my first gig. He brought me on part-time at 508, and so that allowed me to have the skills that when Greenpoint Beer and Ale was hiring, I was able to get that job and one thing to another. Yeah. So I was in a homebrew club with Chris Prout at the Brooklyn Bruisers, and I think that was my in for Greenpoint Beer and Ale. PJ was one of the early members of the Bruisers, and so I knew him from there. So that was when he needed some help, he reached out to me thinking, hey, you're working at the homebrew shop. You must know somebody who is looking for some part-time work and looking to get into the industry. I was like, yeah, let me think about it overnight. I'll get you a list in the morning. And by the morning, I'm like, yeah, me. I can do both. List. Like, get me in on both places. I want to learn two systems. So that was actually, I worked part-time under PJ at Keg and Larin, then went full-time at Greenpoint. PJ brought in a couple people, Ben from the homebrew shop. And then you were right after that, yeah? Then Brett Taylor. And so that was your first gig sort of with Strong Rope?
With Strong Rope about a year before. Okay. I was just working there a day or two a week. And then Keg and Larin was the first full-time gig.
And that's just jump ahead to the future. So you guys now, Brett, you know, I know you'd worked at some point at Six Point. You'd done something at Strong Rope, Keg and Larin. But now you guys are opening Wild Yeast, and you're very close to opening. So, like, what are some things that you've learned, you know, in this step up from homebrewer to now soon opening your own brewery?
Oh, everything. Literally everything that I know. And it's only a fraction of what I need to know. It's hard to pick specifics. I mean, definitely all of the approaches that I want to use, what I've learned in the course of working it at in the tight confines of the basement at Keg and Larin has helped inform how I sort of array my tanks in my space that I'm building. What I've learned at Fifth Hammer is so much of the approach that I use.
Do you guys think that it's better to start that way, to start work your way up from homebrew to working in a very small brewery to kind of prove that you're really interested in it? I mean, it's like paying your dues in some sense.
People ask me this all the time. They come. This happens all the time. Hey, I made my first beer. I want to open a brewery. And so what do I do? I'm like, well, the first thing you should do is see if you can get a job at a brewery. You're like, no, I want to open one. I'm like, yeah. So go work at a brewery. Go flip kegs. Go see what the actual workflow is. The brewers are extremely gregarious. They will work with you. If you are really interested, they see talent and they'll do it. So you go and you work. You'll find out pretty quick whether you want to open a brewery, right?
I'd also argue for making 50 more homebrews.
I know. I would argue for that too, because that's my business. Well, make 50 more and then you'll get the certificate. And then
some of us keep homebrewing even though we're working professionally,
which I love.
Of course. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
And it's very true.
All you people out there, keep doing both.
Keep brewing.
Strive for both.
Whatever it is,
even though
beer.
You're brewing all day, Jeff, you still do some homebrewing?
Absolutely. I'd say on average once a week.
What are you doing in your homebrew that's different from what you're making at Keg and Larin?
It depends on when you catch me and when you ask me. I think a lot of it is definitely exploring the world of New York State ingredients, trying to both replicate beers with New York State ingredients that I've made with all the ingredients that are available throughout the world, and just sort of using them in the, you know, for the unique character that they possess, and sort of following where that leads you and trying to, I mean, I guess more or less to put words on it, is just find new styles, just find where that leads you to. But sometimes it's just trying different yeast and trying different combinations of yeast and bacteria and Brettanomyces and just trying to push different directions just so you have more tools in your wheelhouse when you might have a different idea for a commercial brew.
You know, if I wanted to pretend I was making a beer, I would go take a class of bitter and esters because I know that that beer would come out really clean and technically perfect. But what did you bring? Because you just brought us a growler of something.
This is a Citra Pale Ale, but the interesting thing about this is it has the Norwegian Kvike yeast, the magic yeast that we can ferment really, really hot and really, really quick. So this was done pretty quick. This was probably reached terminal gravity in about 3 days. And you pitch it at 90 degrees and you scream, you know, what else are you going to get out of it? And
you should explain what you mean by that.
So the Norwegians, when they pitch this yeast, which is a non-phenolic yeast that can ferment very hot, if you know anything about brewing, that's very rare. It's pretty much Norwegian. And then in order to scare the demons away that might make the beer bad, you scream when you pitch a yeast, when you add the yeast. And so it's fun. It's a Norwegian scream.
Never made any sense to me, these Norwegian yeast that...
Can you do it, John, on there? Just back up, not right into the mic, but do this. So it's like the Norse gods.
Yeah. Them. Screaming. It feels good. Yeah. We're always... Yeah. Do you scream? Do you guys use Kvike?
No? I have not.
I've only used it at Fifth Hammer. I haven't used it otherwise.
Do you scream?
No.
Well, you know.
We did a show with Pete Langle last year. He had come back from a Scandinavian trip. But so that's part of what you're able to do at Bitter and Esters. You're able to play around with different yeasts.
Yeah. I mean, we have kind of the ultimate hobby shop, so we can do whatever we want. That's the cool thing about homebrewing. And I just wanted to mention, Jeff was at Brewer's Choice repping Keg and Lantern, but he pulled out some homebrew when he was there, which was really cool. I was like, shit, that's great.
And let's talk about style. So, Jeff, one thing I've really been excited about, the beers that you're making the last year, every time you've been on the show, you're bringing in different types of lagers and Kolsch. What did you bring today?
Lunch, my God.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to you. When I look at, in Wild East, Brett, you can aspire to this. I just looked on the Keg and Lantern website today. I don't usually, but I did because I'm meeting you guys. And Jeff, I have to say the beer lineup looks really great. I mean, did you make all the beers on the list at Keg and Lantern?
I'd say over the past couple months I've been distracted by trying to open a second location, and we've had the good fortune of having Oscar Stern with us, and so he's been knocking out maybe two, sometimes three batches a week us, so he's been instrumental in keeping us afloat.
He's a cool dude too,
but I like is how much credit you guys are giving to other people, and that's a really generous spirit. Is that typical for the brewers in the city?
I hope so. That's what brought me in.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's I probably say it every time I'm on this show, but community is what this is all about to me, and it's that, you know, exactly what you're talking about, which is what I'm always looking for more of.
Everybody knows everybody here.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just, and the beer just flows in like a infinity loop. It doesn't really matter who the brewery is. It's just, everyone knows everyone.
And with a few notable exceptions, everybody is really, really supportive of one another. And sorry that I over... I shouldn't say notable.
You're good. I'm just not... I want Jeff to pour one of his beers.
Pour a beer, Jeff. Yeah.
No, but I mean, everybody's very... It's just like... I mean, we're doing an event tonight with Josh Bernstein, his book event party at our space. And it's a first look at our location for Wild East. And... I mean, there's going to be such a huge number of people from the brewing community there, and they're going to be, they're very excited for us. They're like, you know, they've been very supportive. We wouldn't be able to open a brewery without the help that we've had from Fifth Hammer and KCBC especially, but so many other breweries as well.
We just did an event at your place last week, which is all homebrew. You guys hosted homebrewers for a charity event. Dudes do good.
Dudes do good.
Yeah, that was Sam. Great. It was all homebrew. Great beer.
Yeah.
What beer is this, Jeff? This is our second beer.
So this is just a one-off lager that we just put up last week at Keg and Lantern. Very lazily and last-minutely named Saphir Pills. It features a German hop named Saphir.
So. I guess that.
There we go. Sometimes you're under a time crunch and you haven't put in your homework time
before. This beer is called Horn and Dahl Citra. The
one that I poured. Yeah, there we go.
There we go.
Just describing the beer in the name is not the worst thing in the world.
No,
but we have it actually has gotten a better than usual response. I've had a number of people just text me out of the blue in the evenings being like, I'm at Keg and Lantern drinking this. And that's not something that I experience all the time. So when I have five or six or seven people do that within a few days, like, it certainly stands out. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, maybe we'll put some more thought into the name and tweak the recipe and make it again, kind of thing.
How about more homebrewers who actually became pro brewers? We kept talking about Jason Saylor. Just kind of throwing that around. And Jason Saylor is this amazing homebrewer who took the whole New York thing and ran it further than anybody at Strong Rope Brewing.
Absolutely. You know?
So I'm a big fan. Like it.
Yeah. Well, we got a whole room full of love for Jason.
Yeah, absolutely.
We got a whole city full of love for Jason.
And let's keep going. Another one.
Well, I mean, to sort of finish up on where we were going earlier, I mean, I had the fortune of, when I moved over to Keg and Lantern, to be working with Brett, and then when Brett moved to Fifth Hammer, we were able to bring on Alex Biederman. We had him working on Saturdays for us, and then we were able to bring him on full time, and he's just recently moved over to work full time over at Strong Rope with Jason. So you see all these concentric circles and loops. But yeah, then we had Oscar working Saturdays with us, and now he's been able to come on, not full time with us, but full time between us and Fifth Hammer, and just sort of, you know, we had Robert Sherrill was able to come on and work with us for a while before he moved over to LA, and so I feel like certain people are set up at the right size and they're working at the right pace where it's very feasible to bring on somebody who has no experience whatsoever on a commercial scale. So somebody who sort of understands the concepts of how to make beer and certainly has a decent palate and a good mind and a lot of motivation for it. There are certain places around the city that it's natural for them to fit in, for that to be their first job. And I think there's also something to be said for a bunch of us homebrewers always kind of keeping an eye out for trying to lend a hand out to be that first in. I mean, I know for me, when I first started making homebrew and first encountered you because you opened up your back room for us to do the BJCP class at, that was really early on for me. And all I really wanted to do was get a foot in the door and figure out a way into this industry and to think about this all day and to be around all these wonderful people all day. And I was reminiscing about all the wild things I thought I might be able to do early on just to get a foot in the door. And it's insane. I should have never even entertained these ideas. But it was just like, whatever it takes to get in. And I don't think I'm ever going to lose that feeling that I had then and want to make it so much easier for somebody else. There's so many more opportunities now than there were even just 5 or 6 years ago. And it's awesome to be able to turn around and give somebody a hand in.
And Brett, I know you mentioned that at one point you worked at Six Point and you called that the farm team for startups. This was about 12, 14 years ago.
It was I was there in 2011. I was an intern. They had a robust internship program of people who worked maybe one or two days a week. You weren't paid. It was just, you went there because it was aggressive homebrewers who would bring beer down to them and you know, sort of beg for one day a week just basically do cellar work and clean.
But again, that was this in their small Red Hook location, which was again a small, like, what was the system size there?
It's a 20 barrel, I believe.
That's like, their pilot system, right?
Well, nowadays,
I've been in there where they've been. What was the event they used to do?
Beers for Beasts.
I was there a few years with a crew making, you know, batch beers there too. Going ahead, I'm the guy I have to point out where Chris Kuzme actually got started, Kelly Taylor, when Greenpoint in Kelso was in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn. Let's talk about Kelly, because so many people worked for him and started out. Who wants to name names?
Tony Bellis. Tony Bellis used to teach 101 classes at my store. And
KCBC.
KCBC.
Sam and Matt, who have opened Other Half. My understanding is they met there, both worked there and met there.
That's my understanding, too.
I think at one point, Sam was like the main brewer at Green Point / Kelso.
I think for the bulk of the time that Kelly was open over there.
Kuzmi was also a main brewer.
I know that when Five Way Castro Brewery was looking for a brewer, it was Kelly Taylor who recommended Kuzme to Jan over there. So there is this direct connection. And that wasn't that long ago. I want to give shout-outs to Kelly Taylor because just 5 years ago, he was president of the New York City Brewers Guild, and he was running one of the larger breweries in the city. So I think we quickly forget that not too long ago, he was a very important guy.
It's hard to forget Kelly.
And not only one of the... I mean, in a way, one of the larger, but in a way, he was the one at that point who was the most open to bringing in fresh blood and giving people a way in. Yeah, I mean, we're forgetting loads of people, but there are so many people that owe their start to him.
For the Brewers Association, Homebrewers Association, a winner of the national what's the National Homebrewer Award?
Homebrewer of the Year.
Yeah, Pete Salmon.
Pete went on to
Other Half for
Other
a while.
Half, yep.
Yeah, and what is Oscar Brewing? Oscar?
Nope.
No. Homebrewer.
He's a homebrewer. Yeah. Those guys still homebrew.
Yeah, the three of them still homebrew together. Yeah.
But you know, to your listeners, you know, there's a lot of really insider information. But just to get a sense, we keep going on, and you know, there's a lot of people that have come up through this homebrew group. But what's different about New York City then from like homebrewing in Portland or some other place?
I think
because a lot of other places, there's a lot of people homebrewing. I met a guy yesterday. He's a lawyer. He's like, when I was in college, I was homebrewing. He's only like 25 years old. I mean, a lot of people homebrew, but that also doesn't mean are they reaching the levels that you guys have?
Well, I think, you know, in New York, if you're going to homebrew, you're going to really want to homebrew. I think if you're going to take a good portion of your apartment to make beer, then you really, really want to make beer. Robert Sherrill used to tell a story about his husband was asleep on the couch, and he went over to him and he kind of shook him and said, "I'm going to put a brewery in the living room." And he was like, "Yeah, whatever." And the next day, he had a brewery in the living room. He's like, "You agreed to it." So, you know, that's
like
sort of a
drum set. I always think a lot of the homebrew thing, it was like what a garage band would have been.
Exactly.
Another generation.
Yeah. The Ramones of New York.
Some of us don't even have the consideration to wake our partner and trick them into saying, okay. Some of us just show up with the brewery.
Right.
And then it expands and force our to-be wife down the line, to-be wife, to live in the midst of a brewery, just because you're hard-headed enough to
So make thank
it
you
happen.
To all the partners who put up with this. Yeah.
That being said, I can't speak for any other city because I've only been a homebrewer in this city, but I feel like when I look at the Brewman Aries, which is like the biggest, most active homebrew club in New York City and is John LaPaula is directly responsible for its formation, I see a lot of couples that brew, and I wonder if that's because of the size of the apartments. Like, you have to be all in when you live in such a small space.
That's true. I guess we do see a lot of the couples brew, so I guess if you can talk your partner into it. I think a lot of times it's the women talking the men into it to get them brewing. And I want to mention one of my former employees who is a home brewer, became a pro brewer, is Ariel Schwartz. Mm-hmm. You guys know Ariel? She's a brewer at McKellar. Yeah. Just want to mention that. I mean, there's so many of them.
Where are we? I mean, I think, were you and I working when she came on over there?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyways, we probably didn't know each other. I don't know if we were working together or not, but we saw each other shortly after hearing that, and we were just super excited for her. We're always so excited to see the homebrewer get on.
Guys, this is a great conversation. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a minute on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, Its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions, and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Katie Kiefer, and I'm the host of What Doesn't Kill You here on HRN. Every week, I sit down with journalists, authors, scientists, or activists to identify and explain some of the key issues in our food system. I've done shows on food waste, labor issues, meat production, water, you name it, I cover it. You can find What Doesn't Kill You wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Go Katie Kiefer, and cheers to Wisconsin cheese. All right, so we're back talking about homebrewers, how they built New York craft beer scene. John, you had a question.
Well, it's not one of the things that I notice about homebrewers and why they are great to hire in a brewery is because homebrewers will actually read all the blogs and listen to all the podcasts and will have an amount of information that, you know, a pro doesn't have the time for. The pro's trying to make beer, make sure that it sells, you know, running a business. It's a business, whereas homebrewers have that ability to make the hobby be really intense. And that's one thing that I've learned. I learned so much from my customers that they'll come in and say, hey, have you tried this? Or have you done this technique? And I'm like, well, you know, I'm running a business, but this is something I should know. Do you guys see that? Do you notice that, you know, the more you talk to a home brewer, the more home brewing you know about?
Oh, I witness that on all sides. I witness that from starting brewing and going to homebrew meetings and being a sponge and accepting all of that. Being at the homebrew shop and sort of being 50-50. Some people you give all the info you have to them. Some like you're saying, you just take it in, you just let them give it to you.
So how do you guys feel? I mean, I'm not naming any names, but over the years, you know, owning a craft beer bar, there's always that home brewer who comes in with a sample for you to try. And how do you handle that? What if you don't think their beer's so good?
That's my entire life, by the way, just so you know.
But we're not talking about those people.
I know I'm in the minority, but I'm super direct. I'll tell them. I'll be as straightforward as I can about what's going on, what I perceive, what I think is happening, and then start to talk to them about their process and what they're doing and what they might do differently so that they could make better beer the next time around. I don't think there's any worth in trying to beat around the bush.
You know, some of the top homebrew competitions in New York City and things like the BJCP classes, do you think that there is like a level that you can make your mark at as a home brewer in New York? Someone can change that question.
Do you mean, could you be the best home brewer in New York?
Yeah, like if you were a good home brewer and you are the judges good enough and the criteria good enough and the competition good enough that you could actually say, yes, that's a really good brewer.
Yeah, but you know,
considering that millions of people homebrew and a lot of them make just okay beer.
A brewer will make great beer and win a contest, but then the next time they'll still make great beer and not win the contest.
So yeah,
the contests
exactly.
Are fairly subjective, even though they have rigorous guidelines to go by. But you do see that. But you see a lot of the same people winning a lot too, the ones that really, really make good beer.
Yeah. And, you know, to be fair, I mean, I've won a lot of awards in homebrew competitions, and the way to sort of stack the deck is to
brew more.
Is to brew the beers that you know you can win awards with. Like, there are certain styles that, as a pro brewer, I know that homebrewers are going to make better than I'm going to make. And those are like probably Hefeweizen, because I've only made it when Chris Kuzmi from Fifth Hammer wrote a recipe and I followed that recipe. It's not a beer that I don't have a big history with it. Also, like Rosh beer, like I don't do smoke beers really. So I guarantee you a homebrewer is going to make that beer better than I am, because if that's what they care about, I mean, if it's somebody who cares about it, they're going to make it better than I do because they know it, you know?
I certainly think I agree with all that, but I certainly think that if somebody is serious about homebrewing and wants to go further with it, I don't think it takes very long for the word to start getting around. I mean, the homebrew community started very, very tight, mostly because of some of the laws and because of the lack of commercial opportunities that we all had to further ourselves and to move into professional positions. I think that's some of what we talked with Jeff Allworth about after the show here a few months ago, which sort of spurred the basis of this show. But, you know, I think that community was tight, and I think that even though it's grown, it's still tight enough that I only get to two or three of those meetings every month, but I still know a certain number of people and I taste a number of beers. But even if I'm not at a certain meeting, I know somebody else who was. And if somebody's consistently making good beer, it's not going to be very long before we all start hearing about that and knowing that person and tasting those beers and starting to see them sort of set themselves head and shoulders above
and getting a job,
a different group.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully. If that's what they want. Absolutely. Yeah.
We do our monthly beer swap every first Wednesday, where homebrewers come in and share beer. And we've been doing it for 8 years. So I try to taste every single beer. So I can taste 80 beers in a night. But yeah, it's I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records for that.
You've tasted more beers than anybody.
But as far as what I say to people, I generally try to tell them what they did wrong and try to encourage them so that they'll make better beer. And a lot of times the fun thing about that for me is the detective part. Do you guys ever do this when someone gives you a beer?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're like, so what temperature do you ferment this at? Someone gave me something one time and I said, you didn't have enough malt and then you added corn sugar to make the gravity. And they're like, how did you know that? I'm like, because it's on my it's in my mouth, you know? I can totally taste that. So that sort of feedback is really helpful for people. And then in the swap, the good thing is feedback of other brewers also. Like, just one palate's not enough. You can't go up to one person and say, here's my beer, tell me everything that you know about it, because we're all different, right, in what we perceive and what we like. So the community is very important for that. I'm always pushing community for that reason, but it is. It's really important for us all to kind of grow together.
At a meeting, you also, not only are you taking one beer and getting multiple opinions, you're also tasting multiple other beers, mm-hmm. which if you were isolated in a bubble, you'd have to brew all those beers to taste them, to learn about them. But if we all show up with beers and we all share them, then we all grow from everybody else's experience and everybody else's is work.
Brett, just in the article, Jeff Allworth's article, you mentioned one home brewer who inspired you, who stayed as a home brewer, but it seems like he's taught a lot of people. Fritz Furno, tell us about the early days.
Fritz. Oh my God, Fritz is the best guy. Fritz and his wife Jen used to have this apartment on Kane Street in Cobble Hill. And they had an open door policy where basically if their outside light was on, you are welcome to just drop in. And I lived around the corner from them. And I took them up on it, and I met so many people from the homebrewing who, and as a result of what we're talking about throughout the show, the pro brewing community now, I met so many people there, and it was such a great atmosphere, because you would have people who worked at, like, I met Mike Lavullo, who's a
Union Beer rep.
Yeah, and I met a lot of the top homebrewers around, and it was essentially a big bottle swap. We were, there would be bottles of Cantillon coming out, there'd be bottles of homebrew, it would just be all mixed together. You never know what you're going to get, and it was such a great beer education.
That's kind of a New York thing, don't you think?
I think so.
I mean, I don't know. I've lived other places, but New York is so dense that if you're like, hey, I'm a homebrewer, you're going to run into a homebrewer because they probably live pretty close to you.
Yeah.
And so that we end up having this density of people that are attracted to each other. I mean, in all other things, music and art and whatever, you see people kind of together, and homebrewing is just another part of it. So I think that's one of the reasons why the breweries are so kick-ass in New York, is because of the fact that we're all just there.
I'll say one thing I noticed, the last 10 years even, there's a lot more professionalism amongst professional brewers, but also more money and larger breweries. So you might meet a brewer who went to a brewing school, worked at Anheuser-Busch, and is running a big system. How do you think that person's experience differs from what you guys know coming up as home brewers and working in small batches and different styles? I mean, I think character-wise, you guys are more interesting. I'd rather talk to you guys than just a scientist-engineer type.
I'd rather talk to the scientist.
So you guys, I mean, so we have to learn from each other.
No. I mean, I know I love everybody, but those people, when you talk to someone who's like works for Anheuser-Busch, you sit down and you start talking to them about genetics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I get a real kick out of that. I'd rather talk to them, but
I think everybody in this room is spoiled with being able to talk to brewers and the people that Jimmy was sort of tipping his hat to.
Yeah.
So if we do that all day, we're lucky enough to do that all day. So the variant might be, well, you get a scientist. This is great. This mm-hmm. is something different.
Yeah.
So I feel where you're coming from.
Yeah.
But we're certainly more interesting people than they
are. Oh, yeah, of course. Well, you're a bunch of freaks.
And let's go like back. Me. Last question. So 25 years ago, 30 years ago, what was a homebrew shop? And now how has it evolved to what you're doing? And what John's doing at Bitter and Estrus?
Well, when I first started homebrewing was 30 years ago. It was 1992. And the homebrew shop I went to was in Pennsylvania, Nazareth, Pennsylvania. It was somebody's garage. And he milled everything by hand. And the hops were crap and stuff. So I think that what's different now is that my shop gets the same things that the breweries get. And sometimes the breweries will actually come to me if they're out of something. We have basically the same suppliers. So homebrewers have access to not just super fresh and super high quality ingredients, but also the information because of the internet and again, because of the community and everything. So there's definitely a big rise of that information quality. Sometimes homebrewers are like, what? You're out of Motueka? How dare you? And it's like, well, everybody's out of Motueka. Like, good luck with that.
Yeah.
And I love that, actually, because it's kind of like, okay, you're trying to make the best thing that you can make instead of something that tastes like beer.
Right.
And what do you offer in this era where people can buy a lot of things online? What do you offer that makes people come into the store?
Service.
Have you ever met anybody like John LaPolo? Never. While you were shopping online?
How many times have you been on the show? Probably like 15 times.
Yeah, it seems like it.
Well, and for me, like whatever was the homebrew shop in Manhattan in the 90s, it was a place on Spring Street. It was kind of like a hybrid. You could get a home winemaking kit.
Yeah.
A lot of things had cobwebs on them. I bought my first cider making kit there. It was a little barrel. And with a mother, and everything was like kind of like dried and it was either dried or it was like cobwebs, but that was a homebrew shop back then. It was like kind of everything, do it yourself. Maybe they had a yarn class there too. I don't know.
No yarn classes at Bitter and Essers.
No, I think that interaction, and also the building of the relationship. When I started at Brooklyn Homebrew, I was a young homebrewer and I was scared to death of the people coming in. I thought they had more knowledge than me, and they did. Over time you just start to feel that out, but you start seeing the same faces and you start building a relationship. You start to know who brews what kind of things and what they're interested in. You don't have to start from scratch every time. You build on the conversation of where you left off the last time they were in. Yeah, good luck finding that online.
Right, I agree. Thank you.
You can talk to these guys and what you're interested in, they're going to pick up on, and they're going to try to provide more of those types of ingredients for you and serve exactly what you're trying to do, and you can't do that online.
Well, John, give props to you at Bitter and Esters. You're also a community. You know, it's a place to go. It's one thing I like. I like stores. I like going and interacting with people. If I worked all day on a computer, the last thing I want to do is go on a computer at night and explore my hobby.
Yeah, I agree. And we take pride in that. You know, we really want people to come into the store. We have international customers. We have people from all over the world that come in. And it's not because of us. It's because of New York City. So, they you know, a Brazilian, it's easier to come from Brazil to New York City and buy homebrew supplies than it is to buy homebrew supplies in Brazil. So we have millions of Brazilians who come into our store, and they're great. They have fresh, crisp $100 bills. But anyway, that's a cool thing about New York is that it's always been the cool thing about New York is that you see something bigger than your town. You see that you are part of this giant thing that happens everywhere. Everyone knows New York. And people say, you know, why are you the only homebrew shop in New York? Honestly, I have no idea. But I think the main reason is because it's just so freaking expensive to do a business in New York. But we kill ourselves.
But you've also taken it to like the 3.0 level where your service, your classes, your expertise, even if pro brewers are coming to you and asking for advice and for checking out a new yeast or something, you know, and you're doing the Kvike. Is it Kvike or Kvike?
Kvike.
Yeah,
Kvike.
I mean, that's pretty trendy. If you listen to Beer Sessions, really. Yeah. But, and Brett, last thing. So this is very exciting. How about this? You guys tell us what you're excited about tonight, because we're leaving here in a few minutes, and we're going to go to...
All together.
...a construction site called Wild East Brewing in Gowanus, Brooklyn. Brett, you're tell us about this night, because we can't wait till you open, but we're also excited just to go see your space.
Oh, my God, me too. So, we're... We're hosting. Basically, it's Josh Bernstein's new book, Drink Better Beer. It's a release party, and he likes to have them in different places. While at the same time, also he likes to promote new breweries that are going to be opening. So we decided to do sort of a tandem event, and it's going to be we made a bunch of beers that will be representative of the beers that we're going to make. They are all homebrews, actually, so it's very appropriate for this this show. We have a couple of mixed fermentation beers. We have an IPA. We have a Bohemian Pilsner. We have a 100% Brettanomyces fermented beer. Probably missing one, but it's sort of a cross section.
So as you guys are still waiting to open the brewery, you're home brewing. You're still trying out recipes.
Yeah. I have some New York grown ingredients that are sitting waiting for me to get a hot minute to brew a couple batches so that I can do some tests on some yeast and bacteria blends that I want to do. Homebrewing up until the end. So
Jeff, you want to give any props to Brett and the Wild East Brewing team?
Yeah, all of them. Man,
and give us—is there one more beer? That's the last.
It's another of what we opened first.
Pills.
We are inching towards a moment that I've been waiting for ever since I met Brett Taylor, and that is for him to open a brewery that he owns and has direct control over what beers are made and how they are made and how they are presented. I don't think I've ever been as excited for a brewery to open or as happy to see somebody coming as close as we are at this point to realizing, you know, the dream, you know, everything that you work towards and think about and just dream about and, you know, put everything into. I'm excited for tonight because he's so close, but the day when they're actually open to the general public and like that final realization of this whole picture is
amazing. So what's going to happen in about 5 minutes? We're all going to get into a car. We're going to drive from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
We're not. None of us are actually driving.
Gowanus. But we're going to have some fun. Guys, thanks so much for joining me here.
Thanks, Jimmy.
One more time, everybody, say your name and where you're from.
John LaPola, Bitter and Esters, BrooklynNewYork.com. Yeah.
Jeff Lyons, Keg and Lantern.
Brett Taylor, Wild East Brewing Company.
Great. And you're also working at Fifth Hammer. And shout out, big props to Chris Kuzme and Mary Izette. Sorry, thanks to Jeff Alworth for coming and covering the New York City scene. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us on the Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to our producer, Justin Kennedy, engineer, Matt Patterson. And we're trying out some new interns. We got this guy, Kevin, here. Hey, Kevin. And we'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo! Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.